Hello and welcome to Choose a Phi. Today on the show, we have our all-time number one guest. We have J.L. Collins, the author of The Simple Path to Wealth and the incredible stock series on his website, jlcollinsnh.com. And on any Mount Rushmore of the Phi community, J.L. Collins is unquestionably first ballot Hall of Famer on that Mount Rushmore. And he's impacted my life more than I can really describe. His thoughts and his stock series gave me some certainty when it came to investing, and it literally helped me sleep better at night for many, many years. And I do not say that lightly. This is really critical, and what he's imparted to the Phi community has been transformative. So he's been a multi-time guest, and we're going to have an overview here of The Simple Path to Wealth. So with that, welcome to Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
JL, welcome back to Choose FI. It's so good to have you here.
It's an honor to be back. I didn't know I was your number one guest. I should be charging you more.
Seriously. Yeah, I believe that your first episode, which is episode 19, way back when we started in 2017, is still our number one most downloaded episode. I'm 99% sure that's the case.
Wow.
And yeah, you've been so kind to grace us with your presence here a number of times. Episode 34. And then episode, 284 was another one. What is the Simple Path to Wealth? So as I told you before we started, our audience, what's so great about the Phi community is we are a community and we're constantly getting new people into the fold. And even though those episodes have been the most downloaded, it's been about 2 years since you've been on. And I'd love to really just go back to basics and talk about truly what is the Simple Path to Wealth?
I'm up for it. And, you know, I see the same thing in my blog readership is the volume of new readers that come on board is just amazing. And it's gratifying to see. So, yeah, I'm always happy to chat with you, Brad, and I'm always honored whenever you invite me to come back.
Nice. Well, thank you, my friend. I appreciate it. And yeah, like I said, let's go to basics. So I think for most people, the stock market is this impenetrably complex thing that seems akin to gambling. That's sadly the common thought in terms of what is the stock market. And for you and I, and for me, thanks to you and your wisdom, that is the polar opposite of how we see it. So give me just the broad thesis on, okay, what are we talking about here? What are we doing when we invest in the stock market, in index funds or ETFs?
Well, so first of all, the idea that the stock market is gambling is not entirely wrong. The stock market is, there's really two aspects to the stock market. And in my book and on the blog, I liken it to a stein of beer that you can't really, it's not a clear glass, so you can't see into it. And you have this nice head of foam sitting on this glass of beer, and you have no idea how much actual beer is in that glass and how much is the foam. And the corollary in the stock market is the way we invest, which is with index funds for the long term. We're buying the beer. We're buying the actual companies and their performance over time that make up the index. The foam is all the trading that goes on. And the foam is what most people hear about in the news, you know, on CNBC and all these programs. All these people are predicting what the market's going to do today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. That's all speculation. That's all foam. And that is very much akin to gambling. But that's not what I recommend. That's not what you recommend. That's not the way you make money long term in the market. The vast majority of people who enter into that kind of active short-term trading lose, because again, it's gambling. It's akin to going to Las Vegas. But if you invest consistently over time in low-cost, broad-based index funds, and you don't let the market gyrations and volatility scare you out in inopportune times, then the market is the most powerful wealth-building tool that's ever been created.
Yeah, that's pretty strong. The most valuable wealth-building tool that's ever been created. And I think we can back that up. But you're talking about it's the beer. And as you say on page 77 of The Simple Path to Wealth, that's the actual operating businesses of which we can own a part. And I think that's lost amidst that foam, which are, as you say, the traded pieces of paper that furiously rise and fall in price from moment to moment. And I think people really do lose sight of the fact that when you buy a share of stock, and obviously when you buy a piece or a share of an index fund, you're buying a little ownership percentage of a company or many, many companies, as it may be with a S&P 500 index fund or a total stock market index fund. You're actually buying an ownership piece of those thousands of companies. You're not buying a piece of paper. You are a part owner of those companies. And that's, JL, that is a massive difference.
That's an absolute massive difference. And it's an entirely different mindset than trading those little bits of pieces of paper. And moreover, you take it to the next step. And if you're buying a total stock market index fund, which is what I recommend, and specifically I'm a fan of Vanguard's VTSAX, you at that point own a piece of virtually every publicly traded company in the United States of America. And that means you're not just betting on those companies or on the stock market per se. You're betting on the economic power of the United States. Now, there are some people who don't think that the United States has a bright future. And if you're one of those people, then you're probably not going to want to follow the path that I recommend. But if you do think that the United States has a bright future and will continue to be a very dominant and viable part of the world economy, which is how I see it, then there are few safer or more profitable bets to be made.
Yeah, I completely understand and agree. And it's also kind of the zombie apocalypse type argument is what I generally hear, which is, oh, we have to go to gold and guns and MREs and invest in those things, as opposed to, okay, because I think the zombie apocalypse is coming, which is so preposterous. Like, you can't account for that. So it's one of these things. This is our major option when we want to talk about, again, broad-based investing. And it's not just the U.S., because many of these U.S. companies, these U.S.-based companies or U.S. companies that are listed on U.S. exchanges, have significant international pieces as well, right? Like, the operations internationally are massive. So it's not just within the borders of the United States, right, Jael?
Well, exactly. And that's one of the reasons that I personally don't see a need to own international funds. I mean, that's where I differ from a lot of people who recommend a simple strategy similar to mine of broad-based index funds. Most of them say, well, you want to have an international component. But Brad, as you point out, when you own VTSAX or the S&P 500, you are owning the largest companies in the United States, and they are by definition international businesses. And so you are participating in the growth of the world, not just the growth of the United States. And that's important because the world in general is growing. It is getting more and more economically prosperous and has done so ever since World War II. So I absolutely believe that you want to participate in the expansion of the world economies and the world businesses. I just don't feel a need to own specific international funds to do that, because the American companies we own in something like VTSAX have that so solidly covered. And of course, the United States has the cleanest and best regulated rules around stocks in the world. Not perfect by any means, but the best in the world. So you have the least expensive, best regulated, and broadly covering international interests just by virtue of investing in the United States. By the way, no other country or stock market can make that claim.
Yeah, agreed. And like you said, having the laws and rules and regulations of the U.S., I mean, that is very, very important. And it's also, as you said, you're not getting perfection. There's never perfection when it comes to human beings, but are you in all likelihood getting the best accounting standards? Are you getting the best auditing standards? Yeah, in all likelihood you are. Is it perfect? No. But is it something you can rely on pretty comfortably? I, as a CPA, would say, yes, it's something I feel comfortable with. And I think that's very important. And you also mentioned low cost. So let's describe for people what that means in terms of your return, and then potentially how it impacts your overall net worth over a period when you're talking about a high cost fund or ETF versus a low cost one.
Yeah, you can probably get into the particulars of how that plays out over time even better than I can. But just speaking in generalities, Jack Bogle, who is the fellow who created index funds back in 1975, coincidentally the year I started investing, he's also the founder of Vanguard. Sadly, he's passed away at this point. But he was fond of saying that performance comes and goes, referring to actively managed funds. Performance comes and goes, but expenses are forever. And one of his core tenets was you want to keep your expenses as low as possible, because expenses on your investments are like a ball and chain holding you back, holding your performance back. So one of the key things, one of the key advantages that index funds have, and probably the single biggest thing that makes it so hard for actively managed funds to outperform them, is their low cost. They don't have that ball and chain dragging them back. The average fund, I think, has an expense ratio these days of about, 1% or 0.8%, something like that. VTSAX, which we've been talking about, as an example, has 0.04%. So huge difference. Maybe it doesn't sound like a huge difference, but you can comment on how that plays out over time, I think, even better than I can.
Yeah, and I have an old article that I wrote, it's literally 9 years ago, on my original website, richmondsavers.com. And the particulars aren't exactly what we would currently look at, but I think it's directionally accurate enough that I can quickly go through it. So in this example, I said someone who's starting with $100,000 and they save $1,000 a month for 40 years, which for someone in the FI community, saving $12,000 a year, totally not unreasonable at all. And I assumed a 9% gross market return. So I think probably we usually use 8% nowadays in our estimates. But again, it's just an estimate. So using that example, that person would have about $7.2 million at the end of 40 years if there were no expenses taken out. They just matched this hypothetical market. But then I had Vanguard with a 0.05% expense ratio, which is actually a little higher than what's currently. And as you said, it's 4 basis points or 0.04% now, but they lost about $100,000 to fees. So they had about $7.1 million at the end of it. But where it gets really interesting, JL, is if you talk about that typical 1% expense ratio, right? So that person, again, they thought they were getting something better than just a typical index fund, right? Like the lazy person's investment. And I say that jokingly, and that's where we're going to go next, right? But this person lost almost $2 million to fees compounded over 40 years. So they had $5.3 million at the end of this, as opposed to the person who invested in VTSAX, who had $7.1 million. So we're talking a $1.8 million difference just by investing in a fund with a significantly higher expense ratio. That's wild, and that should blow every single person's mind who's listening to this.
Yeah, that's the power of compounding, which works for you in circumstances where you're investing, but also works against you when you're looking at something like fees that also compound against you. The other way to think about it, incidentally, is, and we haven't talked about the 4% rule, the 4% guideline, which suggests that you can pull 4% of your portfolio to live on and expect it to last for the long term. Well, if you're paying 1% fees, that's 25% of your income that is going to pay for your fees, your annual income. So that's another point of reference as to how important seemingly low-sounding fees can be.
And that word seemingly, that's so appropriate because it sounds so innocuous, right? It's just, it's 1%. Who cares? It's just 1%. Yeah, you're paying us for our investing genius. It's just 1%. but yet it's going to cost you millions.
It is insidious.
Yeah, it certainly is. So something that I just alluded to, index funds are really just for lazy people, right? That's your chapter 11 title. So I love how sarcastic and mockingly you put that. But talk to me about that, because you hear that a lot.
Well, so in a sense, it's true. You know, I wrote my book and actually my blog for my daughter, and she's exceedingly bright, but not the least bit interested in this financial stuff. But she has more important things to do with her life. And I appreciate, you know, Brad, you and I are the odd ones out. We're kind of the weird guys that like to fool around with this stuff. But most people have better things to do with their life. But they recognize, or hopefully they recognize, that money is keenly important, and that if you get a few things right concerning money and your investments, your life can be immeasurably better, freer, and with more options. But fortunately, you only have to get a few key basic things right, and those are the things I talk about on the blog and the book. And from that point of view, you can be lazy. Because investing is one of those things where if you get those couple of basic things right, then the less effort you put towards it, the less you tinker with it, the better your results will be. Now, to be clear, I don't recommend this approach just because it's the simplest, although it is, or just because it's the easiest, although it's that too, but it's also the best performing. You know, if I thought, because I'm one of these geeks like you are, if I thought there was a more effective way to invest, then that's what I would have done, and that's what I would have written about. In fact, I spent decades trying to figure out what that most effective way was. My biggest financial mistake was that it took me so long to embrace indexing, because I kept looking for that holy grail, for that magic wand.
Yeah, I mean, it seems counterintuitive, right? Like, that it very is much for lazy people, but yet that's in all likelihood, and statistically, certainly for the significant history that we've looked at this, it is the best way to invest. But that is so hard, again, for, as you're saying, like, in the most lovingly way possible, for geeks like us to wrap our minds around. Because what else is like that, where the simplest way, the way where you use the least brain power, is the most effective way?
Yeah, absolutely. I say that my daughter, because she doesn't care about this stuff, she has a superpower.
Yeah.
And her superpower is that she is set up to automatically invest in VTSAX out of every paycheck. And because she doesn't care about it, she doesn't pay any attention to it. And so when the market has one of its periodic meltdowns, which is a perfectly natural part of the process, it's something you should expect. It's the price you have to pay for the long-term gains. She's not even going to notice. And she's not going to be even a little bit tempted to panic and sell. Unlike, you know, my Twitter and Facebook and blog comments fill up with people who are in a tizzy about this recent market decline, which is actually fairly modest compared to what some of them I've lived through can be. So the key thing is to stay the course. And if you set things on autopilot and forget about, Jack Bogle used to say in the days when statements were mailed to us, you know, he used to say, don't even open your statements for 20 years. Don't even pay any attention to it. And then in 20 years, when you open them, have a cardiologist standing by, because you're going to be so stunned at how much your wealth has grown. But you have to leave it alone. You have to let it grow. As Warren Buffett once warned against, you can't try to dance in and out of the market. That's the way you ultimately lose.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard to get it right. Even one side, if you're dancing in and out, you have to get it right twice. You're on both the sell and then the rebuy side. And the likelihood that you're going
to
do that.
And you have to do that over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the likelihood of that is so slim. And yeah, as you're describing your daughter and her superpower, I literally had like a wave run through me of envy, in a sense that, like, because I'm still that person, even after reading your stuff for years and internalizing this and talking about it on Chooseify, my brain still goes to that kind of lizard brain. I'm scared. I'm reading on Twitter about the meltdown of this investment bank. I mean, currently, as we're recording this, what's going to happen? Should I sell everything? And like, I'm not going to, but that thought is still going through my mind. And I would just, to have that just not exist would be so wonderful. And just, okay, look, every paycheck for the next 50 years or however long I work is just going in the market and I'm not thinking about it. That would be wonderful.
And so much more profitable and so much more peace of mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously. So we've given kind of a sense now of these funds, but I think people do get bogged down sometimes, and especially because, I mean, frankly, your book and your website have become so famous in our community that some people wonder, is it VTSAX or nothing? Is that our advice? Is it, if I have a S&P 500 fund at Charles Schwab, should I sell everything and move the money over to Vanguard and buy VTSAX? And like, I know what my answer is, obviously, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on when you hear questions like that, and also index funds versus ETFs, and are they interchangeable? Just a rough sense of those topics, because they come up incredibly frequently.
Yeah, they do. And it's unfortunate because it's really unimportant in a very fundamental kind of way. So first of all, here's what's important is you want to own low-cost, broad-based index funds. And what exactly does that mean? Well, a broad-based index fund is either an S&P 500 fund or it's a total stock market fund. I have a preference for Vanguard for reasons that we can get into later if you'd like, but the truth is that a broad-based index fund from Fidelity or T. Rowe Price or any of the other big brokerages is fine. They're all very competitive. They're all going to be low cost. Now, how about, do you prefer total stock market or just index 500? I prefer total stock market, but the preference is slight because the difference is slight. These things invest in stocks on a cap, what's called a cap weighted basis. And that simply means that the larger the company, the greater the presence in the portfolio it represents. What that means in a practical point of view is that the total stock market, which is made up of 3,600 roughly companies, about 80% of the holdings is actually in the top 500 companies, the S&P 500. So 80% of the total stock market fund is the same as the S&P 500 fund. That remaining 20% is made up of those mid-cap and small-cap. It's kind of like adding Tabasco to your meal, right? It's a little bit of extra spice. And I like Tabasco on my eggs, and I like Tabasco in my investments. So that's why I prefer the total stock market. But if you are in a 401k, for instance, and they don't have a total stock market fund, they have an S&P 500 fund, you're making a brilliant choice. And when you look at the performance of those two funds over the last 20 years, and presumably over the next 20 years, they're in very close lockstep. Now, clearly, 20 years from now, one of them will have slightly outperformed the other, but it'll be a slight outperformance, and there's no telling which it'll be. It all depends on, over the next 20 years, are mid-cap and small-cap going to be fashionable and outperform large-cap, or the other way around? Who knows? That comes and goes. So anyway, you're splitting hairs on that, and both are fine. If you own an index 500 fund, it will serve you well. Jack Bogle owned the original index 500 fund that he created for all of his life. I think the total stock market fund is slightly preferable, so that's the one I talk about all the time. ETFs versus funds. There's differences between the two, as some of them are subtle. In terms of the portfolio, VTI is the ETF version of VTSAX. It holds exactly the same portfolio. So if you want to hold VTI, you'll get no argument from me. I hold VTSAX because when I started investing, ETFs hadn't been invented. But I would be perfectly comfortable owning VTI. And by the same token, the ETF version of the equivalent S&P 500 fund or the equivalent T. Rowe Price funds, that's fine. It's whatever's available. Those are not the kinds of things you want to worry about. What you don't want to stray into are actively managed high expense funds. So hopefully that clears it up a little bit.
Oh, it does. It certainly does. And like you said, it is splitting hairs in terms of ETFs versus mutual funds and Vanguard versus Schwab versus Fidelity versus whomever. And as always on this podcast, it's not financial advice, but we're just talking about what we personally do, right? And we both personally invest the way that we're describing. But I think everybody, of course, needs to do their own research. But like you're saying, for you, broad-based, low-cost index funds, that's the key. And you're not going to do something crazy like sell at one company to go buy at another company. You like Vanguard because of what they stand for, their ethos, et cetera, Mr. Bogle. But that said, it would be splitting hairs to say, okay, you're at Fidelity, you should sell everything and go to Vanguard. That's not what we're advising at all.
No, I agree with that. If you're at Fidelity and you like Fidelity and you're in their low-cost broad-based index funds, then that will serve you well. And to your point about this is what we do. I mean, in my book, on my blog, I write about what's worked for me, what's kicked me in the ass, and what I tell my daughter to do. And if that resonates with anybody else and they benefit from it, that's great. If anybody reads it or listens to me and says, wow, that just doesn't work for me, then I'm fine with that too. You know, you're free to go your own way. But this is just my point of view. And as I say, what's worked for me and what's kicked me in the ass.
Agreed. And we're actually going to have all of our good friends, Alan and Katie Donegan, on the podcast next episode after this comes out. And Katie's done a really cool job visualizing some. I mean, she's done a ton of research into index funds, and we're going to talk all about that in depth. But on alandonegan.com, they have a really cool visualization of what is in VTSAX. And JL, this is, and we'll include this in the show notes of this episode, but it's fascinating when you look at this, thinking that maybe the top 20 companies or so make up at least, it looks like about 30% of a total stock market index fund. So you're talking, again, on Katie's visualization here, Apple is 5.62%, Microsoft is 5.13%. So if you're putting in $100 into a total stock market index fund, you're actually buying almost $6 worth of Apple and $5 worth of Microsoft, which is actually really, really interesting and speaks to, as you said earlier in passing, that these are cap-weighted funds. And I'd be curious if you could explain more in depth about that. And then maybe we could get into, like, could we ever see something different in the future? But before we get there, let's talk about that cap weighting and how that sits with you when you're putting $100 in and you're really buying $20 or $30 of these top 10 tech companies, in essence.
Yeah, well, that's what cap weighting means, is that, as we touched on it briefly, that when you're in a fund like this, it's going to be most heavily invested in the largest companies by market capitalization, which is the value of their shares. And that plays into two things that I think make these funds particularly powerful. One is a term I coined called self-cleansing, which means that right now, Apple and I forget the other one you mentioned, those happen to be the top companies. But at some point, they won't be. And when that happens, they'll begin to drift down the index, and the fund will own steadily a lower and lower percentage of them. And in some cases, some companies fall off the index. And at the same time, new companies that are created and are growing that become the new dynamic companies of the future, they are the ones that are coming on board. And the worst that can happen with any company in the index is it can go to zero. Now, to be clear, it'll fall off the index before it actually gets to zero, but that's the worst performance. So that sounds pretty bad until you realize that the upside is unlimited. You know, the companies coming up can certainly increase by 100% or 200 or 500 or 10,000. And that's what makes it kind of a rigged system over time to your advantage, that you are going to participate in the growth of the overall U.S. economy, which is, that's capitalism. That's a dynamic thing. You know, the companies that are doing everything right and growing and prosper do well, and those companies that have lost their way fall off, and that's not the same. You know, when you look back 50 years, I mean, companies like Sears and Hewlett-Packard and Xerox, and they were the darlings of the day, right? They were the Googles and the Apples of the day. So the beauty of owning an index fund is I don't have to worry about what the darlings of tomorrow are going to be. I'm going to wind up owning them. And the last comment I'll make along this is the second thing. So that's the self-cleansing aspect of it. And then the other criticism that you hear periodically about the total stock market index fund, or the S&P 500 for that matter, is looking at it today, looking at that chart of Katie's, for instance, people say, well, it's just a technology fund because those top companies are all technology companies, or most of them are. Well, that's true today. That wasn't always true. I mean, I can remember there was a time when those top companies were all energy companies. And you know what? I owned them when they were the top companies. And then when technology took over, that's what I now own. There was a time when financials were those top companies. There was a time when consumer goods were the top companies. So it's an ever-evolving thing. And that's the other beauty. So right now, yeah, it's basically a technology fund because that's what's rocking and rolling in the economy. And as long as that's the case, it'll continue to be that kind of fund. And frankly, that's where I want to be. At some point, that might change. And I'm going to want to be in whatever that new thing is. And I don't even have to think about it. The index fund will do that automatically for me. It's an amazing wealth building tool.
Yeah, it is amazing when you describe it that way, certainly. And because, yeah, I mean, people certainly bring up, oh, should I invest in small cap funds? Should I invest in mid cap funds? And I'm curious how you would respond to that, which I think is inextricably tied to your answer previously, which is just the self-cleansing nature and how you can ride these companies up many, many dozens of X times, but it can only go down to zero. But I don't want to put words in your mouth, obviously, JL. Could you talk to me about when someone comes to you and says, hey, I'm thinking about putting 10% of my money in a small cap fund or a mid cap fund? I know you don't give advice per se, but what's your response to that? Like, how do you help them think through that decision point?
So I think the thing that I've noticed as I've been writing about this stuff for the last decade is it's extraordinarily hard to get people to stay the course with just one or two funds, right? So I recommend when you're building your wealth and you're working and you've got cash flow and like my daughter is at the moment, and there's a percentage of her income that's going into her investments, then, you know, you want to be in something like VTSAX. And you are broadly diversified with that. You're in 3,600 companies, virtually the entire U.S. stock market. Incredible diversification with that one fund. And then when you're living on the portfolio at some point in time, then maybe you want to add some bonds. And not surprisingly, I recommend the Total Bond Market Index Fund for that. Just getting people to stay the course with one or two funds is extraordinarily difficult. Now, when somebody comes to me and says, well, you know, theoretically, over time in the past, when we backtest this stuff, small caps outperform or mid caps outperform. And so instead of being cap weighted the way VTSX is, as an example, maybe if I equally weighted small caps and mid caps and large caps, I would get better performance. And what I would say to that is, well, maybe if you did that, if you stayed that course for decades, if you consistently rebalanced, if you never changed your mind, theoretically, you might have a small edge at the end of 20 or 30 years. I think the odds of you staying that course are slim. I think, frankly, the odds of people following my advice and staying the course with just the one fund are slim. That's the battle I fight all the time. So when people say, well, yeah, you know, I might get an incrementally better performance theoretically if I added these two or three funds, it's like, yeah, maybe, theoretically, but in the real world, good luck. You know, but again, people can do whatever they choose to do and will.
Yeah, I hear you. And certainly we find that as well, that the behavioral aspect of personal finance is way more difficult than, and the psychological aspect, than the nuts and bolts of the money or setting up automated savings or investing in whatever. It's the behavioral side. That is hard. And I get it. Believe me, like I told you 15 minutes ago, I fall prey to this even to this day. It's hard to shut your brain off, even when you have a plan and you know what you, or at least you believe you should be doing. And it's still hard in a crisis. So I get it. I mean, I'm as sympathetic to that as anyone.
Yeah, but it's essential.
It is essential.
I mean, I tell people that if when the market turns down, and it's not if, it's when. The market drops are like hurricanes in Florida or blizzards in New England. You know, they are unpleasant. They can be dangerous. They can be painful. but they should never be unexpected, and they never last forever. And it's the same thing with market downturns like the one we're going through right now. It shouldn't surprise, and the only thing that's surprising to me about this one is that it took this long to get here, because it's really been a long time. We had a very brief one in the middle of COVID, but it shouldn't be at all surprising, and this too will pass. I have no idea how deep it will go before it turns around, but I'm absolutely certain it'll turn around, and you just stay the course. If you're not willing to do that, if you're not able to do that, if you're not able to tie yourself to the mast and not be lured onto the rocks by the sirens, then you don't want to follow my advice. Because if you panic and sell when the market's down, my advice will leave you bleeding in the side of the road. So job one, before you think about any strategy with the stock market, is can you stay the course? Can you stay invested when the market drops? Not if it, because it will definitely happen. And, you know, as Buffett, and I alluded to this earlier, says, you know, the way you lose money in the market is trying to dance in and out. And if you can't resist that temptation, then you're better off not investing in the market at all.
Yeah.
And it's an enormous temptation. I don't mean to, you know, it's enormously difficult to do, but it's crucial.
Yeah, I completely agree. And yeah, like we were saying, it is difficult. So we're sympathetic, certainly, but it's important. Like you said, your advice could actually be if that person is not going to follow it and is going to sell at the precisely most inopportune time, it will leave you worse off, right? So it's absolutely very important that somebody knows that from the outset. So I kind of alluded to this before. I always want to close the loops on things. I hate as when I'm a podcast listener and I don't hear somebody follow up. So I want to make sure I do this. I kind of alluded to the cap weighting of index funds. And I think some people say at the inception of these index funds, the choice was made to cap weight them because I guess there could have been other options. And again, I've heard people say, oh, but that's an active decision, one could say. Do you ever see a time in the future? And I think one of the things that we in the FI community do really well is we look down the road and we understand that we never have blinders on. We understand that the rules of the game are always changing and we need to be aware when that happens. And I don't see this happening anytime soon, but I'm curious if you've put any thought to, could you ever see a time where index fund investing isn't your advice, or that index funds are dramatically differently constituted than they are currently? Like, has that ever crossed your mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's something I think about all the time. I've thought about it for decades. As I said, my single biggest investing mistake is it took me so long to embrace indexing. As you mentioned, it's kind of counterintuitive. And so I literally spent decades trying to find better ways to do it. And ultimately, all paths kept leading back to indexing. And of course, I've been indexing probably for 20 years now. And I do think about that. And I can't imagine something with our current economy and our current stock market structured the way it is that could be more powerful. And that includes the cap weighting. I think the choice to make these index funds cap weighted was a brilliant choice because it's part of that self-cleansing aspect that I think is the cornerstone of what makes them so powerful. So I've thought about it literally for decades, and maybe I'm lacking in imagination. Maybe someday something will come along that will replace it, and I certainly remain open to that possibility, but I cannot imagine what that would be. And so I think for the long term, I'm confident, for instance, saying to my daughter, who is 30 years old and has a lot of investing years ahead of her and who's really not interested in this stuff, I'm very confident in saying to her, just do this for the rest of your investing life for the next 50 years and you will be well served. So that's how confident I am that this will continue to do well. Now, there's always the possibility that something could completely derail the United States. And if something like that were to happen, then yeah, all bets are off. But, you know, we're talking about something of such a huge magnitude that it's not like some other stock approach would have been the better choice It's like at that point, no kind of investing works. You alluded early in our conversation to, you know, gold and guns and canned goods. And I would even say, forget the gold, because at that point, if we ever have a disaster of that magnitude, gold's going to be worthless. Nobody's going to care about a yellow metal. They're going to care about shotgun shells and canned goods and water, you know. So if we ever get to that point, then all bets are off. And there are some people that believe that, that's where we're headed. And obviously, if somebody listening holds those beliefs, then our advice is going to be meaningless. They've probably tuned out of this podcast by now.
Yeah, that's very true. And it's funny because I am the anti-gold person. So the fact that I included that in there was more just the caricature. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, certainly antibiotics would be worth a whole lot more than gold. That's for damn sure, right? So let's
Amen.
Be clear.
Amen. Yeah.
That's funny. But like you said, this is the advice you literally give your daughter for the next 50 years. So, I mean, that pretty much sells it for me in terms of how convicted you are in this strategy. And like we're both saying, we're open-minded, right? This is not some religious text that we're saying it's always VTS AX. It's going to be forever. We're intelligent, open-minded people who are looking at the world as it is. And yes, if things change, I can guarantee you, I will talk about that on ChooseFI. That is a 100% guarantee. Do I envision that in my investing lifetime? It's very difficult. Like you, I've thought about this deeply and I can't envision that right now, but we never can envision big change. But that said, if and when that happens,
there you go.
We're going to talk about it here. That I can guarantee, but I'm not holding my breath at this point.
Well, I hope you invite me back to talk about it because it'll be a topic of keen interest to me as well. But I've been investing since 1975 and I've come to the conclusions and beliefs that I have at the moment by virtue of going down a lot of different paths along the way. And this is the one that's had staying power for me.
Yeah, and that's nearly that 50-year period that you talked about for your daughter, interestingly.
Well, there you go. Now, to be clear, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it's easy to look back over the last 10, 20, 50 years and pick something that would have outperformed VTSAX, but it's impossible to know what that is going to be. And I can almost guarantee that whatever that thing is, it's not going to be that same thing going forward right. For the next 10, 20, 50 years, whereas VTSAX will have staying power. It'll always be a top performer, but there will always be something with hindsight that will have outperformed it.
And that is critical, right? This is what is, in your estimation, the highest likelihood of success, of replicable success moving forward, right? Somebody could always say, and I'm sure something like Bitcoin, right? Oh, you could have bought 1 million Bitcoin at a penny each. And of course that would have done better. Well, sure, but that's not realistic, right? That's a flash in the pan, one-time thing. And we could argue the merits of Bitcoin, and that's not even what I'm trying to do here at all, like dubious as they may be, but that's not replicable. That's what we're talking about. That's why you're saying this is the advice to your daughter for the highest likelihood of success 50 years from now, just plain and simple.
Well, setting aside Bitcoin, you know, taking something else, and I haven't looked at the performance comparison recently or for years now, but Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's investment company, I think is one that over most of that 50 years, and I would guess even to today, has soundly outperformed the broad-based index, right? So someone who chose in 1975 to invest in Berkshire Hathaway has done better than someone who chose to invest in the Index 500 fund that Jack Bogle created. So that's a case of hindsight. Now the question is, what will happen in the next 50 years? Well, you know, Warren Buffett's an old man. Charlie Munger is an old man. And they clearly had the magic sauce, you know, and they are, of course, saying, as they have to say, that the team they're going to leave behind is going to carry on the policies, and maybe, but that's not the history of superstar managers who actually manage to outperform. When they're gone, the outperformance disappears with them. So I would be willing to bet over the next 50 years, the S&P 500, which has that enormous benefit of being automatically self-cleansing, will soundly outperform Berkshire Hathaway, just because Buffett and Munger won't be at the helm. Whereas I don't need anybody at the helm of the S&P 500 because it's self-cleansing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. And I am, as you certainly know, a big fan of Buffett and Munger. And yeah, if you go to their shareholders' letters, which I would recommend for anybody to read, I think it's just absolutely brilliant. You just Google Berkshire Hathaway shareholders' letters, and they have it going back to 1977 here, just these simple PDFs. And literally, JL, on page one, it's the Berkshire's performance versus the S&P 500. And interestingly, yeah, the compounded annual gain for Berkshire from 1965 to 2021 is 20.1% versus the S&P 500 at 10.5%, which is wild.
That's breathtaking. That is breathtaking.
Breathtaking. But yeah, regardless of who they have, and it seems like they have capable people, but yeah, is it going to revert to the mean? Probably more likely than not, but you never know.
Well, what's Buffett recommending to his heirs? He's recommending the S&P 500. So there you go.
Yeah, he certainly is, JL. And actually, that's one of my favorite quotes that I think every single time you've been on the podcast, I've mentioned this, which is from the 2013 shareholder letter for Mr. Buffett. And he said, so he actually had a whole section where he was talking about low-cost index fund investing. And he said, "My money, I should add, is where my mouth is. What I advise here is essentially identical to certain instructions I've laid out in my will." And he goes on to say, "My advice to the trustee could not be more simple. Put 10% of the cash in short-term government bonds and 90% in a very low-cost S&P 500 index fund. I suggest Vanguard's. I believe the trust's long-term results from this policy will be superior to those attained by most investors, whether pension funds, individuals, or institutions who employ high-fee managers." And JL, that is, I mean, almost verbatim what you would say, what your advice is. It's remarkable to read it from Mr. Buffett and hear it from you. I wanted to quickly go back to something. You mentioned very much in passing bonds. So obviously we've talked about equities here, which is just a fancy way of saying stocks and in this case, mutual funds and ETFs. But you mentioned the total bond market index fund as well. And I'd love to hear a little bit about bonds, their place in a portfolio, their place in your portfolio maybe. And just talk to us about bonds because this is an important piece potentially.
Yeah. So the place that bonds have in my portfolio and the way I think about them is as ballast. So as I mentioned earlier, when you're working and you have cash flow and you're building your wealth, and that means that you have a certain level of savings rate, hopefully a high one, and you're diverting that into your investments, then I think you want to be in something like VTSAX or the S&P 500. And you're putting in money on a regular basis, and that cash flow that's going in allows you to take advantage of the times the market drops. In fact, I've gone so far as to say that market drops are an absolute gift to people who are building their wealth, assuming they keep investing, that they don't panic and sell, first of all, but also that they keep investing that money routinely, as my daughter has done all this year while the market has gone down. When you are living on the portfolio and you no longer have that cash flow to smooth the ride, so to speak, then bonds can come in and play that role. And so when the market's dropping, you can shift some of your money from bonds to keep that allocation in place, and that forces you to buy stocks when they're down. Now, having said all that, bonds have been a real problem this year because when you have high inflation and the Fed raises interest rates, rising interest rates are very, very bad for bonds. And so bond funds have gotten hit particularly hard this year in a way that they haven't in the last decade that I've been writing the blog, certainly. And in fact, I haven't seen bonds get hit this hard, well, for decades, because basically from the last bout of huge inflation that we had in the 70s and the early 80s, interest rates have done nothing but drop, which has been nothing but good for bonds. And now, of course, inflation has come roaring back for a variety of reasons that are political and we probably don't want to get into. And now the Fed is forced to fight that fire with rising interest rates, and that is certainly taking a toll on bonds. So VBTLX, last time I looked at it within the last couple of days, was down about 15% for the year, which is a huge drop for bonds. but it compares to a 25% drop in VTSAX. So while it's painful, it's still not as painful as your stock. So it's still providing a little bit of that ballast, not the way you would prefer to see it. But all of this is perfectly to be expected. You know, when you have inflation and you're going to have rising interest rates, it's going to take a toll on your bonds, and there's just no way around that. That's all the bad news. Now, the good news is that if you own your bonds in VBTLX, which is a total bond market fund, which is the way I recommend owning your bonds, you own thousands of bonds of all different maturation dates. And that means that at any given point in time, there are always lots of bonds in that portfolio that are maturing. And a maturing bond gets the money back. And that means that the portfolio has that cash to go out and buy new bonds. And the new bonds that they're buying, of course, are the bonds that are paying these higher interest rates. So slowly but surely, your portfolio, which is been made up of bonds paying fairly low interest rates, which is why their prices drop so badly, slowly but surely that is going to be replaced by bonds paying these higher interest rates. So the total bond market fund, which was paying, I want to say, like 2.5%, that interest rate will slowly grow and its price will stabilize and it will be fine over time. But again, just like with the stocks, it all depends on you not panicking and selling. So you just need to stay the course. But your bond funds will be fine over time because your fund will continually replace the old with the new.
Yeah, that's akin to the self-cleansing nature of the index fund that you described, right? In essence, this bond fund is self-cleansing just with higher rate bonds.
Exactly. And because it's also an index fund.
right. Which works out perfectly. So, JL, when you were saying that rising rates are very bad for bonds, so that's rising rates are very bad for existing bonds that already have a set interest rate. Could you describe that a little further? Because I'm sure there are a lot of people who are not all that familiar with bonds.
Sure. So maybe we should start at the beginning and real briefly talk about what a bond is. So a bond is a loan that you make to either a government entity or to a corporation. And if you own your bonds in VBTLX, you have bonds of both kinds. And the way a bond works is it will have a certain duration. And that duration can be almost anything. I mean, there are very, very short-term bonds there are some bonds that are only a day long, for that matter, and then there are bonds that are 30 years long. So there's a duration. But let's, for the sake of argument, say you're buying a 10-year bond. And that means that you agree to lend your money to some company for a period of 10 years, and they in turn agree to pay you a certain interest rate for those 10 years on that money. And that interest rate will be determined based on whatever prevailing interest rates at that moment are. And then you will get that same interest rate for the next 10 years. And then at the end of 10 years, you will get your $10,000 back. Let's say it was a $10,000 bond for 10 years. You'll get your $10,000 capital back, and you will have collected interest for those 10 years. And so if you hold that bond to when it matures in 10 years, then you have collected the interest that was agreed on, and you get your original money back, short of the issuer defaulting or something terrible like that happening. Now, the problem occurs, or the varying situation occurs, if you decide you want to sell your bond within that 10-year period of time. So let's suppose that the agreed-upon rate of interest that they're paying you is 3%. Well, if interest rates have gone up to 5%, nobody is going to give you $10,000 for your bond that only pays 3%, right? So that's why the value of your bond is going to go down, and the bond market will very accurately adjust the value of your bond down to accommodate the fact that it only is paying 3%. And that will make it marketable to people that otherwise might buy a new bond at 5%. Hopefully that makes sense. By the same token, let's suppose that, as has happened for most of the last four decades from the 1980s, interest rates were dropping. Well, now, let's suppose you owned that bond, you bought that bond, you know, sometime when interest rates were 8%, and now interest rates have dropped to 3%. Well, clearly, you're not going to sell your 8% bond for only $10,000. It's worth a lot more. So the value of your bond has gone up. So what's happening now is that that process is reversed because interest rates have bottomed and they've started to go roaring back up because that's how the Fed is fighting inflation. So that's what's hurting the value of bonds at the moment. But none of it matters if you hold the bonds until they mature, right?
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. It makes perfect sense. So right in that last example you just talked about, somebody would actually pay a premium over that face value of that bond because the
right.
the interest rate on your bond is higher than the prevailing interest rate they could get just by going out and buying another bond or a new bond. So that makes perfect sense. Now, I wanted to kind of fast forward. So now, okay, we're talking about today where there is higher inflation, the interest rates are increasing. What would someone do? I mean, we hear about I-bonds, which are these government series I-bonds and such, which currently at the time of recording, for at least until it resets in November, which might happen before publication of this date, it's like 9.62% or some such, which is significant, albeit only on $10,000 is the maximum that each individual or entity can put in. But I'm curious, like, have you heard people ask you about these I-bonds or other options other than a total bond market index fund? Is that something that's crossed your plate?
Oh, yeah. So I particularly the I-bond question has come up a lot. I tend not to pay too much attention to I-bonds because it's, you know, if $10,000 is a significant part of your portfolio, and I recognize for some people it is, then maybe that's something you want to look into. But remembering that the interest rate on I-bonds is very volatile when interest rates are rising. So it can be a two-edged sword. I think there are more dangers associated with them than people recognize. I wrote a post a number of years ago. I think I called it the bond experiment, where I was sort of looking into other bond approaches other than just the total bond market index fund. And I experimented with a couple of them, and I don't remember it exactly, so I'll leave it to people. You can put it in the show notes and people can read about it. But eventually it occurred to me that what I was doing is chasing performance with my bond portfolio, and that's not the reason I held bonds, because the truth is bonds, in my view, are not a great way to chase performance. They're that ballast in the portfolio, and that if I want a greater performance, the simplest way to do that would to be to allocate more money to the stock portion of my portfolio, because stocks are where your performance comes, right? And bonds are where your ballast comes from. So I just thought this is kind of a ridiculous thing to do. I have started to get some comments on my blog from people who are saying things like, my bonds are down worse than my stocks are this year. And if that's the case, they're certainly not following my advice. And because, as I said, and this is one of the things that caused me to look up the decline in VBTLX, which is about 15% year to date, as opposed to VTSAX, which is about 25% year to date. And I thought, hey, that doesn't seem right. I'm sure there are some bond portfolios, some bond strategies that are down more than stocks. But if you're following those, you're not following anything that I have suggested. So, you know, you are, it occurs to me that you're chasing performance with your bonds, which I think is a mistake. That's not why you should hold bonds. It's not a good way to go after performance.
That makes sense, certainly. And I'm curious, and again, yeah. we don't give financial advice per se, and we certainly can't give individual financial advice to many, many people. But in terms of thinking about constructing a portfolio, so you're talking about in there, your return or the significant portion of it being from equities, but yet bonds do play a part potentially in some people's portfolio. I'm curious, do bonds play a part in your portfolio today? And how do you think about that?
Yeah, so I have about 20% in bonds, which for somebody my age is considered low. That's considered very aggressive on the stock side. And I think of them as ballast. You know, it used to be in the old days when interest rates were higher, and we may be going towards those days again with interest rates going up, that, you know, you own bonds for two reasons. One is a ballast for stocks, but also they generated income. You know, bonds typically in the old days would generate 5, 6 5% interest. And of course, we haven't seen that in a long time because interest rates have come down. Now they're going back up again. So maybe when things stabilize at some point in the future, that, you know, bonds will be having that attractive interest rate being paid out. There's certainly disadvantages to rising interest rates, and the way bonds are performing is a good example of that. But I remember when interest rates were declining, you know, people were saying that's really hurting people who are saving because the interest that you get on your savings account is declining. The interest you get on your bonds is declining. And all of that was true. So the investment market changes.
Yeah, it does indeed. And we always need to be aware. And I'd be remiss. So you said you've used the word ballast a number of times. And I'd love to kind of drill down on that and get your exact definition. But as I understand it, you're talking about, okay, I have X percent of my portfolio in terms of this total bond market index fund. And let's say that's 20% of it. And like you're saying, maybe in the last number of years, it was making 2 or 3% in terms of interest. Maybe now it might be ticking up to 4 or 5, 6%, who knows. But so that's 20% of your portfolio that's making that in terms of income. Now, in a perfect world, bond prices are not volatile and all over the place. And so there's more certainty there, I think, is, you know, again, I'm saying that kind of jokingly, as you're saying, the bond market index fund has went down 16% or some such, but in normal times. And then I guess that provides some level of a way to smooth out your overall returns. But I don't want to put words in your mouth, certainly. Like, how would you describe ballast in terms of a bond aspect of a portfolio for somebody who is brand new to this type of investing?
Yeah, so first of all, this year has kind of thrown a monkey wrench into the whole process because, you know, interest rates have just been skyrocketing, and that's been very damaging to bonds, as we talked about. So in a way, bonds are failing in their role as ballast. Although, while they're down 15%, that's still better than being down 25%. So they haven't entirely failed, but that's an unpleasant acknowledgement, if you will. But theoretically, the idea is that when you are working and you have the flow of income, as we discussed before, and you are investing on a regular basis, then any time the stock market drops, the amount of money you're investing each month buys more shares. So stock market drops actually benefit you because you're accumulating more shares. Now, when you stop working, you want something else to play that role to smooth the ride, because that smooths the volatility of the stock market for you. It allows you to take advantage of it. And that's the role bonds can play, because when you own bonds and the stocks are dropping and you're holding a given percentage of them, in order to keep that allocation even, let's say it's 80-20 like mine, you're going to be shifting some of your bonds into your stocks, which means you're buying those stocks at that lower price. Now, that works a whole lot better when your bonds aren't also down significantly. But it even works when there's a gap between, you know, the amount your bonds are down and the amount your stocks are down. It still works to a certain extent. So, for instance, I might even see a time coming when I might shift all of my bonds into stocks if stocks go down low enough to make that worth doing.
Very interesting.
But again, I'm a fairly aggressive investor, so I would be comfortable moving into 100% stocks, particularly if I could pick them up at bargain prices.
Yeah.
But they'd have to go considerably lower than they are now. But give me a 35, 40% decline, and I might not own bonds anymore.
Nice. Yeah, it's nice having that money there, almost in essence, as a reserve, right? Because you can make that reallocation.
As a reserve.
That's great. So again, you don't give advice to anybody but your daughter. And I'm curious, you said she's about 30 years old. Is your advice to her be 100% in equities now and for some time period? Like when would you advise her to reconsider that 100% equities if in fact she is currently at 100%?
So first of all, she's 100% VTSAX. And my advice to her would be, if she ever decides to quit her job and the earned income goes away, that's the point where she'll want to add bonds. So let's suppose, you know, and unlike the traditional career path that people my age tended to follow, which is you got out of college, you got a job, you worked for 40 years, and then you retired, you know, she might decide at 35 she's going to step away for a few years to do something else. Well, at that point, she might want to add some bonds. And then maybe when she's 40, she goes back into her career, back into a different career, and she has earned income again. And, well, at that point, maybe she steps away from the bonds and goes back 100% in equities. So she can go back and forth between those two during her life, depending on her work circumstances and the flow of earned income.
Wonderful. That makes perfect sense. JL, thank you so very much for coming back on the show. It's always a pleasure to see you, to hear your wonderful voice, and to just really refresh this, because it's so critical, regardless of, like me, you've been learning about this for 10, 15 years, or somebody who's just getting started. This is really bedrock foundational principles of the FI community. And as always, really appreciate you coming on.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. As hopefully you can tell, I love talking about it. So anytime you want to chat, I love hanging out with you, Brad. So thanks.
Nice. Yeah, I would absolutely love it. And so I mentioned, obviously, the book, The Simple Path to Wealth, your website, JL Collins NH. And you actually just got back from the Chautauqua in Columbia. If people want to learn more about the Chautauqua event, we actually did an episode a number of years ago about it. And Jonathan and I went to the, I guess it was the 2018 Chautauqua, but you have a website, fichautauqua.com. Is that the best place if somebody wanted to get their name on a list for next year's events, if they were so inclined?
Absolutely. That's the place to go to get your name on the wait list. Chautauqua sells out almost instantly. And so for anybody who is interested in participating, you definitely want to get on the wait list, because when we release tickets, we let those people know first. So you have first chance at it. If you don't know what Chautauqua is, and I imagine that a lot of your newer listeners don't, you can go to my blog, jlcollinsnh.com, go to the search window and type in Chautauqua, and it'll bring up a whole series of posts that I've done with links to posts that other people have done, and you will know more about Chautauqua than you probably care to. And of course, if you go to the fichautauqua.com website, you'll find information there too. But it's an awesome experience. We had a brilliant time in Colombia, which is a beautiful country just filled with wonderful people who were extraordinarily welcome to us. And Chautauqua always attracts people from all over the world who are just fascinating to hang out with, and it's a privilege to become friends with them. And they become friends with each other, and that's the real magic of the week. And we limit it to only 30 people, so that you really have time to get to know and really form relationships with everybody in a profoundly deep manner that's incredibly satisfying.
Yep, wholeheartedly agree, and I can vouch firsthand. I've made lifelong friends who I still keep in touch with, certainly. And yeah, Chautauqua is a difficult word to spell, so if you're looking for it, just go to the show notes for this episode. And we actually, I looked back up, and it was episode 64 where we had that roundtable of a whole bunch of us talking about really the wonder of Chautauqua. So for anybody listening, go back to Choose a Fi, episode 64. And JL, thank you again for coming on.
My pleasure. Anytime, my friend.
Thank you for listening to today's show and for being part of the Choose a Fi community. If you haven't already, the best ways to get involved are, first, subscribe to the podcast. So you're listening to this on a podcast player, just hit subscribe. And then subscribe to my weekly newsletter. I actually sit down every Monday and write this by hand, and I send it out Tuesday morning. So just head over to choosefi.com/subscribe. And it's really, really easy to get on the newsletter list right there. And I would greatly appreciate it. It's the best way to get in touch with me. You can actually just hit reply to any of those emails, and it comes directly to my inbox. So that's the way that I keep a pulse of the community and how we keep this the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show. And finally, if you're looking to join an in-real-life community, we have Choose a Fi local groups in 300-plus cities all around the world. So head to choosefi.com/local, and you'll find a list of all of those cities in 20-plus countries all across the world. And if you're just getting started with Fi, or you have a family member or a friend who you think would be interested, two easy ways. Choose a Fi episode 100 is kind of our welcome to the Fi community. And even though it's a couple years old at this point, it still stands up. And it's a really great just starting point to get an understanding of what is financial independence? What are we doing here? why are we looking to live a more intentional life where we save money and use it as a springboard to live a better life? And then Choosify created a Financial Independence 101 course that's entirely free. Just head to choosify.com/FI101. And again, thanks for listening.